We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session December 5th, 2013, to consider the matter entitled United Mine Workers of America on behalf of Mark Frank versus Emerald Coal Resources LP, docket number 10-2012-250-B, and United Mine Workers of America on behalf of Ronald Foy versus Emerald Coal Resources LP, docket number 10-2012-251-D. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, Commissioner Nakamura, and Commissioner Alvin. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith. Good afternoon, Rory.
Good afternoon. These cases are before the Commission on complaints of discrimination filed by Mark A. Frank and Ronald M. Hawley against Emerald Coal Resources pursuant to Section 105C3 of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977. Emerald operates Emerald Mine No. 1, an underground coal mine in Greene County, Pennsylvania. At the time relevant to this case, September of 2011 to November of 2011, Emerald employed Frank and Hoy as development at its mine. On or about September 22, 2011, an anonymous complaint was made to MSHA pursuant to Section 103G of the Mine Act. Section 103G provides a miner the right to obtain an immediate inspection of the mine when he or she believes that a violation of a mandatory health or safety standard exists. The filed complaint alleged, in part, that a fire boss had not conducted an adequate inspection of a belt mine at the mine. Following receipt of the complaint, the MSHA inspector conducted an investigation of the mine. During the investigation, the MSHA inspector took statements from approximately 34 miners and supervisory personnel, including Frank and Hoy. On or about September 28, 2011, Frank was approached by an MSHA inspector about the hazard complaint. Frank told the inspector that he knew the name of the fire boss who had failed to perform the examination. On the same shift, Frank was called into a meeting that included representatives from MSHA, Emerald Management, the UMWA, and the miners' representative. Frank refused to provide the name of the fire boss who had allegedly performed an inadequate examination. He again refused to provide a name at a meeting held later in the day, and once again refused to provide the name at a meeting held the next day. On October 4th, 2011, Foy was called into a meeting with representatives from MSHA, the UMWA, and Emerald Management. In response to a question from a MSHA inspector, Foy explained that he observed several occasions when an examiner had not properly examined the conveyor belt. However, Foy refused to name the examiner responsible. On October 4th, 2011, the MSHA inspector finished the investigation, concluding, in part, that there was no evidence that a fire boss had improperly performed belt examination. After the conclusion of the MSHA investigation, and over the next few weeks, Frank and Hoy repeatedly called into meetings with Emerald Management and asked to identify the fire boss who had allegedly performed inadequate belt examinations. Frank and Hoy maintained that they had provided the name to David Moore, the safety representative, and they were not required to provide the name to management. On November 9, 2011, Frank and Hoy were suspended for 7 days for failure to provide information concerning serious allegations of safety violations to Emerald Management. On November 10, 2011, Frank and Hoy filed separate discrimination complaints with MSHA, alleging that Emerald had retaliated against them for participating in MSHA's investigation of a Section 103G hazard complaint. Frank and Hoy alleged that after they participated in the investigation, they were harassed and suspended for 7 calendar days. The MSHA inspector investigated the allegations in the discrimination complaint and found no evidence that Emerald had violated Section 105C of the Act. Thereafter, Frank and Hoy each filed a complaint of discrimination with the Commission pursuant to Section 105C3 of the Act. At a hearing before an administrative law judge, Frank and Hoy alleged that Emerald interfered with their rights under the Act and requested compensation for the 7 calendar day suspension and to have any reference of the suspension removed from their work records. On June 6, 2013, the judge issued a decision concluding that Frank and Hoy had each established a prima facie case of discrimination. Specifically, she stated that the miners engaged in activities protected by the Mine Act when they made complaints to a UMWA safety committee man, when they provided information to MSHA during the course of the Section 103G investigation, and when they provided information to Emerald during the mine's follow-up investigation. The judge further concluded that as a result of their involvement, Frank and Hoy each received a 7-day suspension and that the miners demonstrated a nexus between the adverse action and the protected activity. Emerald had argued that Frank and Hoy were disciplined solely for failing to provide mine management with the name of the fire boss whom they accused of not conducting a proper examination of the bell. The judge concluded that this defense was pretextual. At the time Frank and Hoy was suspended, Emerald already knew the name of the accused fire boss based on information it gained from others, including information about the date and shift of an allegedly inadequate belt examination. Accordingly, the judge ordered Emerald to take back pay to Frank and Hoy and for the operator to post her decision at the mine. Furthermore, she ordered that Emerald remove all reference of the suspension of Frank and Hoy from their personal files. On review, Emerald argues that the judge erred in finding the complaint of suspension from the mine violated Section 105C of the Mine Act. In particular, the operator contends that the judge erred in finding that it had not established an affirmative defense. Emerald maintains that his suspension of Frank and Hoy for refusing to cooperate in an investigation of a potentially serious safety hazard was a legitimate and credible business justification. Frank and Hoy contend that the judge correctly concluded that Emerald discriminated against them in violation of Section 105C of the Mine Act. Specifically, the miners argued that the judge correctly concluded they proved the prima facie case of discrimination and that the operator failed to prove its affirmative defense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. I believe Commissioner Young is going to start off today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lori, thank you for shepherding this case, managing the record, and providing us information, keeping us up to date on developments in the case, and I do appreciate it. This is an odd and difficult case. First of all, it would be easy to cast this as a paradoxical looking glass adventure where the mine operator has decided to prosecute or persecute miners, not for complaining about safety, but for not complaining specifically enough about safety. In that event, you look at the situation and you wonder who's really concerned about safety. You know, the operator seems to have a record of disciplining people for not performing these examinations. And consistent with that, wanted to perform a thorough investigation. It was thwarted in this attempt by these miners who, having made the allegation at some point, weren't willing to provide what the operator's counsel today characterized as an indication of seriousness of purpose behind his allegation. So that's interesting. We have union officials on both sides of this argument, with the safety committeeman and union president being called by the operator as witnesses, and with the national union defending the complainants. But at the end, it's not for me to cast the facts, to find the facts, to weigh the testimony, evaluate the evidence. That's the judge's job. And while I can certainly understand and sympathize with the operator's position that there are bases for questioning the judge's credibility determinations, and most of the relevant findings of fact, I don't see a basis for overturning the central findings of fact and the credibility determinations which underlie her decision. I do have some sympathy with the operator in this case because it's in a no-win situation. It is charged, and I don't think I can count how many times I've brought up Section 2 of the Act and noted that it's the operator's job to ensure that the mines are safe. It's not the agency's job. The agency can't be everywhere. One of the genius moments of the Mine Act is reinforcing the duty to provide a safe and healthful workplace for the employees who work in the nation's mines. And that is the operator's responsibility. And consistent with that, one would hope that in a best case scenario, management and labor at the mine would work together towards that purpose. When you have a situation as you have in this mine where the operator is willing to entrust to the safety committee important responsibilities such as the intake of complaints and concerns on safety matters and the responsibility for following up on those and addressing them at least at some level. In general, that is a very good thing for safety. And I would hate for anything that we decide today to be an impediment to that type of relationship and that type of trust anywhere, at this mine or in any mine in the country. At the same time, the Act and our jurisprudence recognize the extraordinary difficulty of establishing a discriminatory act subject to action under Section 105C has occurred. Rarely do you find direct evidence of all of the elements: protected activity, adversity, motivation, a nexus, joining them. So we're allowed to look at circumstances and to determine it. This case is different in another way because I don't think there's any question about the nexus here. If you're going to find that there was protected activity, and you can't help but find that a week suspension without pay under the circumstances is an adverse action. The proximity in time between what the miners refused to provide to the operator and the action was pretty much instantaneous. The pointed motivation of the operator is unquestioned. The miners wouldn't answer the questions that the operator wanted to have answered. It's the ultimate motivation of the operator that really creates a problem in this case. That and whether there was, in fact, protected activity. And in both cases, it's a very close call. Regarding the protected activity, I would not agree that it's protected activity as a general matter to refuse to provide information as part of an operator's good faith safety investigation. These were serious allegations, and they deserved to be treated seriously. The operator, by all indications, there's no controversy about this, conducted a thorough investigation, interviewing numerous witnesses in following up on this matter. This was coincident to or in conjunction with MSHA's own investigation and with the investigation conducted by Mr. Moore, the Safety Committee representative. So this was in fact a serious matter and deserved attention. The problem with establishing that it's protected activity per se to refuse to provide this information is that at some point the information is really important. When you're making an allegation of this nature, it has severe consequences potentially for the people involved. As was noted, this is potentially a matter for criminal prosecution. Certainly a matter for enforcement action by MSHA and by the Pennsylvania Office of Deep Mine Safety. As the evidence tended to indicate in this case, it's a fireable offense at this operator, at this mine. So once that bell has been rung, one can understandably side with the operator's inclination to want to make sure that the people making those allegations are willing to support them if it comes to that. The problem here is that you had a report made by the miners pursuant to the aforementioned policy, which allows them to report these matters to their safety committee members. And the miners testified that they did so. While there may be some discrepancies in the number of meetings, and there's certainly a disagreement in the testimony between the minors and the operator's witnesses, particularly Mr. Moore. The judge, as I've noted previously, made findings of fact on this and credibility determinations that, that affirmed what the minors had to say on the matter. Once that issue is presented to the safety committee by the minors, in my view, the operator then has the obligation to deal with the safety committee. This is something that is consistent with a policy it has established, and I think that, as even Mr. Moore acknowledged, it wasn't the names themselves that were necessary, but rather the fact that somebody was willing to state fully the circumstances on the record for attribution. That was necessary to taking any further action the operator might have wanted to take. Unfortunately, it was also something that created a great deal of leverage and pressure on the minors involved. And because that's the case, I think it's important that we be alert and wary to the possibility that that any actions taken in this context would be seen as exerting a chilling effect on the minors' exercise of their rights under the Act, including but not limited to the right to contact the agency with a certain degree of anonymity pursuant to Section 103G of the Act. In this case, to me, it seems like the operator may not have been likely to take any further follow-up action were it not for the fact that MSHA had been brought in to investigate the situation independently by somebody. Once that circumstance is brought in, the fact that we don't know who instigated the MSHA 103G investigation and should not know, actually works to create the type of uncertainty and the types of qualms about reporting safety matters that we should be concerned about. And that bothers me a great deal in this context. I don't read Section 103G as broadly as Ms. Carr does. I don't think that all of the inferences that she draws are necessarily supported, and I don't think that this case is a proper vehicle for us broadening very much our understanding of how 103G operates. The important thing for me is that a Section 103G investigation was a key part of the context of this case. And once we have established that context, it is vitally important to make sure that that minors can believe in the integrity of that process, the confidentiality of their participation. There were a number of difficulties that the operator either participated in without any evidence of ill will or intent to intimidate or coerce anybody, but difficulties that it's easy for me to Monday morning quarterback here and say, for example, I don't think I would have operator representatives in these meetings. They don't have a right to be there, as Mr. Moore noted. They could at any time a witness can ask to have a confidential meeting, but if you do that, are you throwing a spotlight on yourself? And I think that's a reasonable question for minors to ask if you're required to do that. I don't think the agency should put minors in a position where they have to be in that position, where they have to make those kinds of decisions. I think in general, the identities of witnesses and people making complaints pursuant to 103G should be kept confidential. That goes beyond not rendering them in writing, as 103G literally holds. But as I've said, I don't think it's necessary that we make that part of the decision. I'm just stating it as part of my explanation of how I came to my conclusion in this case. And my conclusion is that I would affirm the judge, essentially. I think that we are bound to accept her credibility determinations because, while they're not immune to our dissection and reversal, we are bound to give them great respect and to overturn them only, I believe, when they are illogical or where they are contradicted by or contradict facts that we either know or that have been established elsewhere in the decision, to the point where maintaining those determinations and those findings of fact is untenable. My position at this point is that I don't think that they are. But the argument today gave us a lot to think about, and I'm stating this as a preliminary position. It's a position that I've maintained for some time during my review of this case, although it was not reached without some difficulty. But I'm very eager to hear what my colleagues have to say about these issues and retain an open mind to consider and perhaps change my views. But I think that in this case, the protected activity, to me, seems to be pretty clearly the participation in the 103G investigation. And as Mr. Moore noted, candidly, the provision of the names wasn't a literal fact that the operator was especially interested in. It was a surrogate or a proxy for something else. I don't believe it's unreasonable for the operator to expect at some point that these minors would establish a seriousness of purpose. But at the same time, that's not the only potential motivation for this kind of thing. And certainly I look at the possible effect that a decision adverse to the minors in this case might have in making other minors think twice about exercising their rights under the Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Next, Commissioner Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I too would like to thank Rory for the work on the case and input into my thinking. Before the oral argument this morning, I was inclined to affirm the judge's decision based on substantial evidence. For much the same kind of reasons as Commissioner Young's articulated. The oral argument raised a number of significant and really quite profound questions about Section 103G of the Act. And before I can be sure of how I think the case should be decided now, I would need to review the transcript of the oral argument and reflect on it and discuss the case with my fellow commissioners. Obviously, that's not possible in the hour between the oral argument and this meeting. I'm thinking, Commissioner Young said that the case is not the vehicle to articulate how Section 103G operates. I'm not sure about it. I really need to think about that because I think 103G and how it operates is at the heart of this dispute, and we may need to get into that. But I don't know as we sit here today. I want to think it through what I can do today. In terms of the methodology that we have for analyzing discrimination cases. The first inquiry, of course, is whether it was protected activity. The judge found protected activity here in three respects. The complaints to the UMWA safety committeeman, Mr. Moore, by Franks and Hoy, the participation in the MSHA investigation and the participation in the subsequent investigation by Emerald. I'm not sure that the third of these reasons is protected activity under the Act, particularly given what the nature of that participation was, but I think that the first two certainly are protected activity and that protected activity has been established. There's no question about whether there was adverse action, both in the 7-day suspension itself and in the effect of that suspension on the permanent employment records of Mr. Franks and Mr. Hoy, both of whom spoke about that in the course of their testimony, that this was going to have an adverse effect going forward, and it seemed like that was as important, perhaps more important, than the loss of 7 days' pay. As to discriminatory motive, the Commission has articulated a number of ways that this can be inferred from circumstantial evidence. Understanding that, as Commissioner Young said, you're virtually never going to have direct evidence of a discriminatory motive in one of these cases. One way is closeness in time, and as the judge found, this has been established. Second way is knowledge, which the judge did not touch on, but I think Emerald certainly had knowledge that Franks and Hoy made the complaint to the safety committee, if nothing else. The third is hostility. And there's an enormous dispute in this case about hostility. The judge found it relying in large part on two facts, as I read her decision. One, that Emerald did not ask more for the name of the fire boss, which Franks and Hoy had provided to him. And secondly, that Emerald knew who the fire boss was from the MSHA interview with Mark Cole. Both of these are hotly disputed, both as to what happened and the implications of what happened. But the judge based her findings on credibility determinations, and I think that from my own reading of the record, I think that the credibility determinations were valid, certainly within the judge's purview. We've talked a lot about the factual dispute between David Moore on the one hand and Mr. Franks, Mr. Hoy, and Mr. Baer on the other hand. I think the more critical credibility determination that the judge made, particularly in terms of when she got to pretext, was the finding about Mr. Shifko, where the judge said, I find Shifko to be a polished but disingenuous witness. I think that's a critical finding in the case. And my own reading of the record, without going into detail, supports that finding. I think it was entirely proper to find that Mr. Shifko was a disingenuous witness. So given the judge's credibility findings, it seems to me that the Commission should find that substantial evidence exists to support the judge's inference as to the finding of hostility. The fourth is disparate treatment, by the way, and I have questions about the judge's finding of disparate treatment. But even without disparate treatment, I think that there's evidence here to ultimately affirm the judge's conclusion of a prima facie case under the substantial evidence rule. Then we turn to, the judge turned to affirmative defense, and I think there's some confusion here in terms of the articulation of what happens once a complainant has proven a prima facie case. Our jurisprudence establishes that the operator may rebut the prima facie case by showing either that no protected activity occurred or that the adverse action was in no part motivated by the protected activity. And then there's an additional level. If the operator can't rebut, the operator still can prove, can defend affirmatively by proving that it was also motivated by the miner's unprotected activity and that it, the operator, would have taken the adverse action for the unprotected activity alone. I think what we have in this case is that those two analyses, the rebuttal and the affirmative defense, were smushed together in the judge's decision and were not sorted out by the parties in the presentations they made to us in the briefs or the oral argument, and we're kind of stuck with it. They're smushed together because it seems to me that the company really was saying that the protected activity of Franks and Hoy had absolutely nothing to do with the decision to suspend them, which would be the rebuttal defense, but the judge didn't look at it as a rebuttal matter. She looked at it affirmative action, which, and an affirmative action, it's a mixed motive situation. The company is essentially acknowledging that they had several motives and that they would have taken that action on the motive that was untainted by protected activity alone. We just don't have that in the analysis here, and I think it's unfortunate. It would be better if we did, but we don't. I would conclude that the judge, as I sit here today, I would conclude that the judge was correct in finding that the reasons advanced by Emerald as its sole reason for disciplining Franks and Hoy was pretextual. It's pretextual in the sense that maybe they were seeking to find out who that fire boss was, but they were also doing more than that. This was a point that Commissioner Alton was questioning Mr. Hank Moore about. The testimony by Christine Hayhurst: we suspended them because we wanted to teach them a lesson. I don't think that's the same thing, and I don't think it can be subsumed in the "we needed to find out." This is the Emerald's view of the presentation. We needed to find out who those fire bosses were. And if there's something more than that, we wanted to teach them a lesson, then we're into an area where pretext becomes an issue. And I think that while I don't necessarily agree with everything that the judge said, I think that there's enough in there, in what she said, to support the finding of pretext. All of that being said, I think we really need to look, as I sit here today, and I'm not, I want to hear more from Commissioner Young on this, by inclination, is that we need to look deeply at 103G. The questions, the issues that were raised in the oral argument, I think particularly by the UMWA, in terms of protecting the anonymity of the both the miner who comes forward and the miner who was accused of the act, And I hope we do that in the ensuing weeks. And I think, but we also have to be very sure when we do that we do it in a way where our decision will not deter other minors from coming forth with 103G complaints. And I think that has to be the touchstone of our decision when we ultimately make it.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Commissioner Alton?
Thank you, Chairman Jordan. When Commissioner Young said he was eager to hear our remarks, I was glad to hear because I was eager to give you my remarks. But now I'm a little chastened by Commissioner Cohen's very thoughtful description of the case and the necessity to look at 103G very carefully in the context of this case. And this case is, in one sense, it's a small case because it's suspensions for 1 week, which is very important to two men, but the scheme of life may not seem a lot. But I think it is a very important case because it does have to do with the interaction between the operator and minors in safety matters and investigating safety matters. Although it's probably not necessary, it may not be reaching our decision since the union, but by the way, I want to thank the union for its excellent presentation, did a wonderful job. However, to the extent that the union asked us to render a Johnny's Boy poultry kind of ruling, in which participation in an interview about safety matters is strictly voluntary, I at least can never imagine, I'm actually somewhat astounded the union would ask for that. I can't imagine myself ever going for Johnny's Boy poultry. Johnny's Boy poultry was issued because the National Labor Relations Act bars employers from discussing protected activity, interrogating workers about protected activity. It is an exception to a bar. There is no such bar in the Mine Act with respect to talking to employees about safety matters. As a matter of fact, the Mine Act encourages miners to assist with safety matters. So while certainly there is a bar against, and there should be, and we should enforce it rigorously, a bar against discrimination on the basis of safety matters, I would not want to inhibit employers from talking to minors about safety matters. And I guess that brings us to this case in particular. I'm just going to focus on the affirmative defense because, to me, that was the weakest part of the judge's decision, the one that causes me the most concern. Certainly, both Commissioners Young and Cohen are right, is that the standard here is substantial evidence. Substantial evidence is relevant evidence that a reasonable mind would accept as adequate to support the conclusion. Substantial evidence rule requires that the Commission reasonably consider material evidence on both sides, including evidence that detracts from the administrative law judge's conclusion. Now, here we will be applying substantial evidence in the context with respect to the affirmative defense, as Commissioner Cohen said, in a pretextual decision situation. Now, the Commission has many times expressed itself in many different ways about the standards of a pretextual defense, or affirmative defense to pretext. It has said the raising of affirmative defense necessitates an inquiry into whether the proper business justification was reason, quote, enough to have legitimately moved that operator to have disciplined the minor, close quote. At another point, we said, once it appears that a proper business justification is not plainly incredible or implausible, a finding of pretext is inappropriate. At another point, we've said, of course, we have also explained that this affirmative defense should not be examined superficially or be approved automatically. We said that we must determine whether they are credible, and if so, whether they would have motivated the particular operator's claim. And there are a number of indicia as to whether these pretextual, the affirmative defense pretextual meets these standards. So we've said pretext may be found where the asserted justification is weak, implausible, or out of line with the operator's normal business practice. And finally, in my quotes, I won't bore you with any more, we've also said that ultimately the operator must show that the justification is credible and would have legitimately moved it to take the adverse action in question. So now if we put substantial evidence on top of the pretextual finding here that this was pretextual, it seems to me that our view of this case has to be, in applying the substantial evidence standard, it requires us to determine whether taking all the evidence both what the administrative law judge referred to and other evidence to the record. All that evidence, you know, if there's sufficient relevant evidence that a reasonable mind would accept the conclusion that the operator's affirmative defense is weak, implausible, or out of line with the operator's normal business practice. Or I'll use one of the different standards. It says we can rephrase it to say whether taking all of the evidence into account, there is sufficient relevant evidence that a reasonable mind would accept the conclusion that the proffered defense is not credible and would not have motivated the operator to mete out the discipline. So that's the context of review in which I have looked at this affirmative defense standard. Now, at least at this point, I don't believe a reasonable mind looking at all the evidence would conclude that the proper defense is not credible and would not have motivated the operator to take the credit, mete out the discipline. Let's go through what the decision said. First, the evidence the judge referred to. Both Commissioners Young and Cohen referred to the timing. Well, there's no dispute that the discipline was meted out as a result of the refusal to provide the requested information. I can't see how timing is even relevant aspect here. I mean, I would be more concerned if they waited 6 months and said, you know, we've decided to suspend you for a week because you didn't tell us 6 months ago what you did. I mean, I think discipline always follows, should follow close in time if there's a specific act that causes it. Discipline should always follow close in time. So I don't find timing is even suspect here. I'd be more suspicious for the board passage of time. Next, she says, Emerald argues that the failure of the fire boss to conduct the mandated examination is a serious safety issue and it attempts to analogize to the Pack v. Maynard Dredging Company. But she distinguishes Pack v. Maynard Dredging, saying that in that case there was a policy, a well-established policy requiring mine personnel to report safety matters. Well, it's true that here there may not be such a clear-cut policy, but there is evidence in the record that they had a policy that said that you could have discipline up to including immediate discharge without prior corrective action for insubordination, refusal of fair to perform work assigned or to comply with supervisory direction or do other things not relevant. And number 7 was violation or disregard of company safety rules and or state or federal statutes or violation of any commonly accepted safe work practices. Neither of those, of course, expressly say you have to report safety matters or that you have to answer our questions about safety matters. But just as we interpret the Mine Act liberally to encourage safe mining practices, I think we should interpret these personnel policies liberally to encourage safe practices. And it seems to me that when an operator asks a question relevant to a very important safety matter like fire bossing, it is incumbent upon the employee to answer. I don't think there's a right of the employer, of the employee, a miner in a general circumstance, to refuse to answer safety-related questions. That's why one of the many reasons I wouldn't accept Johnny's boy, Poulter. Then she says, here I have found that the complainants not only alerted more a member of the safety committee, but also identified the fire boss. And that's kind of goes to the credibility and the finding of the judge, and I think we accept that. I think we have to accept the judge's finding that the company somehow knew the names. However, knowing the names on the basis of somebody's told me, these two fellows told me these are the persons, is different than having your witnesses ready. I think the union president is correct that you would not have brought discipline, or you wouldn't have won in discipline, if you didn't have witnesses ready to go in and say, I personally know of the violation. Just hearsay wouldn't cut it, and the company can't take action on that basis. So I think this direct information was critical to a company investigation as to whether fire bosses were not doing their job properly. Then she says, even though Imshin, the names possible, there were two names of possible fire bosses mentioned at the hearing, and both were interviewed by Imshin and mine management. Even so, the mine questioned Franks and Hoy and demanded they directly provide the names of the fire bosses they accused, and continued to do so after Imshin left the mine, even after Imshin left the mine, after it found the allegation regarding the belt examination was without merit. Is she suggesting that once Imshin left the mine, the company should have, like I said, they said, phew, glad that's over, we're not going to do any further investigation? Crazy talk. No, after the, because one of the reasons we can calculate that NMSHA couldn't take any action is they didn't have direct evidence of the violent conduct because Franks and Hoy wouldn't tell them the names of the fire bosses. They were essentially in a situation where they weren't going to help the investigation. NMSHA issued citations on other belt complaints under 103G. It couldn't on this because they didn't have direct information. NMSHA leaves, company properly continues the investigation. I don't see NMSHA's leaving as having anything to do with this. I do understand the 103G part of it, but not NMSHA's leaving. She says Franks and Hoy were the only minors disciplined. Well, they were the only people who refused to give the necessary information. I mean, who should have been out there disciplined? Cole, should he have been disciplined? He apparently recanted his testimony. She doesn't talk about whether the recantation was correct or not, but it's understandable. If somebody backs up and says, actually, I don't have any names, you're not going to discipline them. So I don't understand why the two people who wouldn't give the names or the only person's disciplined really has anything to do with this. Then she says, based on all the facts, I cannot agree that Emerald has demonstrated a legitimate purpose for the discipline. I find that the stated purpose is not credible. None of those facts actually convince me that the purpose is not credible. I don't see how a reasonable mind would conclude that means the defense is not credible. It is instead a pretext to punish Franks and Hoy for making a complaint about the fire boss. While I agree it is important to discover whether or not a fire boss has conducted required examinations, the mine had several opportunities to discover who was accused, and in my view, based upon information gained from others, including information about the date shift, the mine did know which fire boss was accused. But they didn't have witnesses who said they had direct knowledge of the misconduct who were willing to come forward, but who said they had direct knowledge. In fact, they said they had documents that would prove the misconduct, and they were willing to produce the documents or come forward with the information. And then she says there could be no other reason to continue to harass Frank and Hoy about a name. It's two or three meetings. Three meetings with Frank, two meetings with Hoy. I'm not sure that I put that in the category of harassment, to sit down and say, you've said that you know directly and have documents that fire bosses haven't been doing their jobs or didn't do their jobs. Please tell us who that is so we can investigate it. We're going to investigate it. They say no. They leave. They come back another time and ask them again, Hoy twice. I don't see that as very harassing. And that's particularly in the case when we look at, so that I think is a fair summary of what the judge said is why this was pretextual. That standing alone doesn't convince me that a reasonable mind would say the affirmative defense is not credible. However, if we look at the other evidence, I become even somewhat more convinced at this stage. The operator didn't seek these Franks and Hoy out. NMSHA essentially brought them to the operator. So this wasn't where the operator knew that there was a complaint about fire boss and they said, let's go out and see if we can find out who made that complaint. They were brought to them in an NMSHA investigation. At all times, there were union representatives present to protect them, as they should have had union representatives present. But they had union representatives present. There's no evidence in the record that those union representatives or they ever said, hey, I think we're being harassed here, or this is making me really uncomfortable. And they had their lawyers, their union representatives, with them. She talks about a right that they exercised their right, the DLJ talks about the right to go to the safety commitment. But there's no right to withhold this kind of information, in my opinion. That's obviously my opinion. When you have important safety information, you do not have a right to withhold. So, I don't, again, the Mine Act specifically envisions miners assisting in safe mining practices. Additionally, it's clear that the operator had disciplined people for these kind of offenses. That there is solid testimony of that. So discipline was realistic on that. Additionally, they could have avoided this discipline by giving the names. If they already given the names to the safety committee members and the company already had the names, if they just said, okay, it's Jones and Smith, there would have been no discipline. Now, I guess the notion is that would have somehow compromised their rights to not talk to management and tell management directly what they'd already told management indirectly through a safety committee member. If their testimony is, we told Dave Moore and he told the company, then they're saying that somehow we had an important right that Dave Moore would tell the company the names, but we wouldn't tell them the names. They could have avoided the discipline. They held the keys to their discipline. Next to finally, I think it would be very difficult to write this opinion, to affirm this judge without the possibility of creating a terrible policy. MSHA ordinarily creates policy. In this case, we may be creating policy with respect to interrogation of employees and safety matters. And I think it would be terrible if we created a policy that said workers, minors, can simply refuse to answer safety-related questions, and that if they're disciplined for that refusal, it constitutes discrimination under the Act. I think the union president got it right when at the hearing they said, and let me ask you a question, a quote question, and let me ask you, we will sort of cut to the chase. These two individuals were suspended for 7 days. Answer, correct. Question, do you disagree with that action by the company? Answer, no. Question, why not? Answer, I look at it, it's everyone's, there's responsibility is for everybody's safety in that mind. During this very serious allegation, we take this very seriously. Our local, myself, and the safety committee have zero tolerance for any type of unsafe activity, especially of this nature. Safety overrides everything in the Mine Act. I think it's reasonable. I don't think a reasonable mind would conclude, to go back to substantial evidence and pretext, I don't think a reasonable mind would conclude that it's not credible or that it's out of line with company policy to think that the company would have disciplined workers who refuse to provide crucial information in a safety investigation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Austin. Commissioner
thank you, Chairman Jordan, and thank you, Rory. Maybe you can help me decide this case. It's a difficult case. I think before this morning, I was inclined to find, well, let me say this, that I do have some problems with the judge's findings with respect to the company's proffered explanation for the suspension. In particular, there are two things, and I'm not sure it was mentioned by Commissioner Alton, but after MSHA concluded its investigation, we know that the company instigated its own investigation, and if they had only brought these two individuals in and said, give us the names, I think I'd be more inclined to conclude that they were being subject to harassment. But the evidence is that there were 15 other miners questioned as part of Emerald's investigation. I don't know if it's in the record, but Mr. Moore said this morning that Christine Hayhurst, the human resources manager, was there at each one of those investigations, interviews. And I think I would have to conclude that somehow, in order to affirm the judge on her findings here, that they did all those interviews as that was part of the pretext, and somehow they did all that to try to throw people off the scent that they were really out to get these two guys. So I think her, and then also her finding, as Commissioner Alton said, and also Commissioner Cohen, that these other 15, and I guess the 34 employees that were questioned by MSHA, I guess there was certainly some overlap there, that it was evidence of discrimination that none of them were singled out. And I think, as Commissioner Alton said, well, that's because none of them, I'm assuming, because we weren't there, and I don't know if it's entirely in the record, but we can conclude from the record that these two were the only ones who who continued to say, I have evidence, I know who it is, but I'm not going to give it to you. So I think those were critical findings made by the judge, and I'm not sure that what's left, as I sit here today, and I'll certainly look at everything, especially given what Commissioner Albin said and Commissioner Cohen, to see whether, you know, the sort of the house of cards falls with respect to her finding that there was discriminatory intent. That said, though, I am, you know, it's such an important case, I think. Miners in the mine are very important in reporting safety violations. I mean, they're the ones who work in the mine. They're all over the mine. They've got to report these things, and how we decide this case may have an effect on either promoting that or perhaps hurting that goal. And I do want to, the fact that this whole situation occurred in the context of a 103G, I think is very important. But I'm not ready, as Commissioner Cohen said. I need to have some time to weigh those arguments. And it's particularly important to me because if on the basis of the, if I find that it wasn't pretextual, I do want to at least look at every way or every argument that the counsel for the complainants have made before I determine that this case should be affirmed or reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Kumar. I also have struggled with this case and have kind of found myself sitting comfortable with, on the one hand, considering reversing the judge's finding of pretext, at some point in my consideration of this matter. But at this point, having continued to think about it, and especially from the beginning, I have been troubled. I mean, I have realized, because I think that an outcome that serves to just allow the miners' rights under 103G to be chilled is very problematical, and I feel that it is our duty on the commission to, as we consider cases and consider how 105C should be construed, that we also have to consider it with the proper content, you know, pari materia, and with how 103G should be interpreted. And I find myself just at bottom considering Congress's mandate, you know, with 103G, they were aware of the need to protect miners against possible discrimination. Section requires that the name of the person filing the complaint, this is with the 103G, and the person any miners referred to in the complaint not appear on the copy of the complaint, which is served on the mine offer. While other provisions of the bill carefully protect miners who are discriminated against because they exercise their rights under the Act, the committee feels that strict confidentiality of complainants under 103G is absolutely essential. So given that, I can't help but think to myself, you know, at this mine, when all is said and done, the perception, I fear, is going to be that miners are aware that there was a 103G complaint filed by someone or some people. And two miners wound up being suspended as a result of all the activity flowing from the 103G and investigations that occurred. And I have to think that people are probably going to think, and those two miners are the ones that probably got, you know, that got the ball rolling with talking to the safety committee. And I don't really think I mean, as Commissioner Cohen said, I mean, I feel that given the fact that the miners complained to the safety committee man, he said that he went and did an investigation. He spoke to the, you know, all the fire bosses. It's hard to conclude that people didn't understand, or, you know, Frank and Hoy had a concern about exams being done. And so at the end of the day, the people who complained about exams not being done are suspended, and, you know, somehow in there was a 103G file that kind of prompted certain activity that wound up with them being suspended for a week. I feel that that's just going to have a terribly chilling effect. And so I am seriously considering, you know, how that gets analyzed with 105C3. I think that there may be situations such as this where the company, yes, I believe companies, and it's a serious obligation, they do have to investigate matters. They do have an obligation to keep the mine safe. Here, you know, I think the judge, though, she looked at this and she kind of thought, well, by the time you were questioning, conducting your own investigation, several people had looked into it, and, you know, you proceeded to talk to people. It didn't seem like this particular piece of information that you were seeking was going to be essential, that the only way you could get it was from these individuals, and it didn't seem likely to be successful to obtain it. And I don't think it's proper. I agree. I'm troubled. I wouldn't want to issue opinion that somehow has a holding that miners have a right to refuse to answer a question. I don't think that's the right way to look at it. That doesn't really, you know, kind of make sense to me conceptually. But I mean, these miners, they didn't provide the information. I mean, why would that be? I mean, we do know that Hoy, you know, indicated he called the MSHA inspector that night, and he called him because he had said, you know, yes, if I had any trouble. And my reason for calling him was, October the 5th, I was in the lamp room, and a gentleman came up to me and told me I had a big target on my back for talking to the inspector. So I think that we have to just be, you know, very cognizant of that, and I think that the 103G rights do play into this. Exactly how, I don't think I agree with everything that the union has urged, that there's, you know, a total confidentiality of every single minor that might be referred to in a complaint, even the wrongdoers, and they can never be revealed. I'm not sure we have to consider, you know, all those aspects in this particular case. But to me, somehow in toto, I think that the judge reached the correct conclusion, and I think that her credibility finding regarding Mr. Shepko is a big part. I mean, he is the operator's person. He is the one that's saying this is, you know, why we were doing what we did. This is what we felt was important. We had to get to the root of this. But she found him disingenuous as part of her conclusion that the motive was pretextual. And, you know, the context of this investigation is very troubling, where, you know, 103G is filed. Of course, MSHA needs to copy the operator and let them know that they're there, you know, in response to a 103G request. Certain items are alleged as unsafe conditions in the mine. So the operator is made aware of this. They're calling, you know, particular people out of the mine. Mr. Boyd, you know, Mr. Frank, come in to be interviewed. As Mr. Morse indicated, the Admiral deserted as what it believed was its right to accompany MSHA, apparently, and be present during the interview. It just doesn't seem like it would be designed to ensure any confidentiality. It seems like it would be sort of the antithesis of confidentiality. And so I feel that, for these reasons, I can affirm the judge. I'm not entirely sure of the scope of the opinion. I don't anticipate that I have no desire to issue, the broadest possible ruling. And I agree with my colleague, Mr. Alvin. I don't think I would issue a ruling that a minor has a right to refuse to respond, to employer's request. It is very much a decision that I make in the context of this case and this record. And for that reason, I would affirm the judge.
Madam Chairman, can I make one other remark? Because you brought up some excellent points. I think we do have to be sensitive as to whether this could have a chilling effect on other miners at the mine. And since this is the only time I can talk to all four of you together, just throwing out a question, sorry. The local union supported this action. The local union president said this was appropriate discipline. Came to the hearing, subpoenaed, but came to the hearing and said this, which seems to be at odds with the notion that this discipline somehow chills the workforce, since the workforce through its union supported the action. So either the workforce supported the action, or the only other way to look at it is the workforce actually was trying to retaliate against Frankston Hoy because they might have been naming other union member fire bosses for possible disciplinary action. So that gets me to the remark about target on the back. That's an uncorroborated hearsay statement, presumably made in the lamp room, by an hourly worker. You've got a target on your back. I don't think he was saying management's put a target on your back. I don't think that's who he was talking about.
I agree.
I think what we have here is miners who are refusing to talk, miners who are refusing to give critical information because they're intimidated not by management, but by union colleagues.
I agree. No, I fully agree that it's very possible the target that he was fearing retaliation or from coworkers.
So I don't think you can hold that against management. That's not an element of discrimination by management.
But the question is whether management can suspend Hoy and Franks for refusing to provide names under those circumstances. And if we assume, and I was trying to thrash around the same question, what was going on out there, that the fire boss was a union fire boss. And Hoy and Franks wanted the fire bossing to be done well, properly, and they went to Mr. Moore, and then they felt that that wasn't resolving the situation, and an anonymous complaint was made to MSHA under 103G, and then the investigation started, and there was blowback against Hoy and Franks from people. And we know that Mr. Swetz was there. I think he said pretty clearly to protect the union fire bosses.
Well, he said everybody. He sort of.
Well, but then more specifically, he spoke of the union fire bosses, and it's not that Hoy and Franks did not also have union representation from mine committees. They were there too.
Right.
But it seemed to me that Swetz's interest was in protecting the fire bosses, and that it just became a very difficult situation for.
I completely agree that Hoy and Franks were really between a rock and a hard spot, if that's correct, which we can, since we're just talking here, we'll assume is correct for the moment. But I don't see how that then plays into the affirmative defense, how that weakens, in fact, that strengthens the affirmative defense, because the fact that the union might have put witnesses to unsafe activities in a tough spot because they didn't want information about other union members. Doesn't mean that the company didn't have an obligation to try and find it out and say, you know, I appreciate your difficulty that you're going to be naming colleagues, but if fire bosses aren't doing the job, we've got to know it, and if you won't tell us, that's a disciplinary matter. So I don't see all of that to me strengthens the affirmative defense rather than weakens it.
It may weaken the fact, though, that they had union representation at those meetings.
Well, you're correct. Their lawyer might have been somebody else's lawyer, really. You know, you're right. Yes, I agree. You got me on that one.
Can I just make a couple comments?
Go ahead.
In response to a lot of this and taking advantage, as Commissioner Alton noted, the fact we can all speak about these things now. Commissioner Cohen talked about the difficulty of the arguments running together on the rebuttal and the affirmative defense. I didn't view this, I wanted to hear what other people had to say about it. I didn't view this necessarily as the arguments running together. The fact is, continuing in the vein of this being kind of a special case, there's only one motivation and one motivating fact here, and it's the same one. The proper motivation and the improper motivation are the same motivation. The operator just had a disagreement with the judge and Mr. Franks and Mr. Hoy as to whether it was proper or not. I don't think anybody disputes that the action that was taken here was because they refused to provide these names or sufficient detail in response to the company's questioning on the issue. So when you say that the arguments run together, the fact is that there's no pretext in the pure sense of we fired him or we suspended him because he was late to work 4 days or used his cell phone too much when he was on the job. It's no. We all agree why these guys were disciplined. It's a factual matter. They were disciplined for not offering up the information that the company wanted. The question is, what is the legal effect of that refusal? So this isn't really a case, I don't think, where you even get to an affirmative defense. You get to an interpretation of what significance particular actions have. Regarding that, I do want to clarify, I don't view the questioning by the company as being an onerous interrogation. The fact that you speak to people on repeated opportunities or repeated occasions to try and give them an opportunity to give you the information you're looking for, it doesn't seem to me that there was any undue duress applied except for the duress arising from the natural circumstances. And that's where we get into a couple of things that have come up here that I do think are important, but just kind of lurk in the background. One is, when we talk about the targeting and the fact that it was union miners, fellow rank-and-file miners, perhaps, who were making this insinuation about other rank-and-file miners putting a target on somebody's back, you have to remember here that this is a situation where the company understands this. They know what the effect of these guys naming names is, what it's likely to be. Getting an agent to do your bidding for you unwillingly, if that's what happened, and I'm not suggesting the company concocted some scheme here, but you know, when you talk about seriousness of purpose, they understand that it's serious in part because there's a possibility of reprisal or being made an outcast or shunned by your fellow miners, and I don't think that that's something that the company could possibly have been unaware about. The second thing is that the behavior of the local union in this case, and their understanding of the situation, you have to remember, they had a view that accepted Mr. Moore's version of the fact versus Franks and Hoy's version of the fact. Not the same version of fact. They didn't testify in a way that, I mean, their testimony was in conflict, and that conflict had to be resolved. That's where you get to the point, in my mind, where it's important how the judge resolves these conflicts. When you look at whether the union witness testifying at the company's subpoena and saying that they supported these actions, if you have a system in place and you're going to believe your safety committeeman and that it was reported to him and that he says that he wasn't given the names, that it was only brought to his attention on one occasion by one of these complaining witnesses, then you're looking at that as a different set of facts, and supporting the company's actions in that context might make more sense from a safety standpoint. If you look at it the other way, the way the judge considered the facts and accept the miners, Franks and Hoy's version of the facts, that there were repeated meetings, that they were earlier in the process when something could have been done, you have to question whether that, if the union had that set of facts and there was no disagreement of testimony, whether they would say, we support what the company's doing here in interfering with the right of these miners to come to their safety committee men and make a full statement and try to resolve it that way. I think there's a fundamental dispute here between the local union and Franks and Hoy about whether they brought this complaint into the safety process the way it should have been brought in. And if the union doesn't believe that these miners did that, then it might take the position that the company, exercising its obligation to carry out a thorough investigation, ought to have the right to get that information. So I think that could be addressed, by considering those other facts. Finally, on 103G, I'm certainly open to taking a look at that and how it affects the decision. I'm with Commissioner Cohen. It maybe needs more thought. I'm trying to stake out a preliminary position, but if this is something where we want to take more thought and perhaps have more discussion on it, I'm certainly open to that and obviously believe I could be wrong in thinking this is not the case. This may be the case, and if somebody brings a good case for articulating how 103G operates in this case, then we can do that. But what I'm looking at is something Commissioner Alton said, and this is how this colors the way I view the fact. As he noted, MSHA brought these miners to the operator, and my point is exactly. That's the thing that bothers me about this case, and that at the heart, if you accept the miners' testimony about what happened and how they proceeded in this case, and I believe we have to because the judge has made findings that are supported by substantial evidence on that. Really, the only fact that is very remarkable here is that there was a 103 investigation at all. So when I say I don't think we need to get into the details of 103, it's the fact of that investigation setting the context and setting the stage, not so much the way 103G might operate in particular cases. I'm with you on Johnny's poultry. I don't think we need to get into that, and there are some differences between how the Mine Act operates, and I certainly do not want to have a decision where we come out and say, you have some right to not participate in, to not cooperate in an operator's good faith safety investigation, regardless of context. I just think the context is a little different here. Thank you.
All right. I'm trying to figure out where we're at here, if we have enough information to even know at this point to go forward, how to draft an opinion, or where we're at. Commissioner Alton, you would be voting to reverse
it. I right now today would vote to reverse. However, I forgot this whole teachable moment thing does cause me some trouble. If I concluded that the company had said, we're not going to do anything about the fire bosses, I mean, there's too much in favor of them, I mean, and so that they, if I thought they were sitting in that disciplinary meeting thinking, well, we're not going to do anything, so let's talk to these guys one more time and jam them up for it just to prove the point. That causes me some trouble. I mean, I wouldn't be ready to go one way or another on that because it's somehow balancing the need. I mean, in one sense, the miners do need to know that they need to, that they should, in their interest, put inside the union context, to cooperate with the safety investigation. It's very important that they cooperate with safety investigations. On the other hand, you don't want to have a chilling effect. There's a downside of cooperating with safety investigations. So that the teachable moment sort of thing, if this was just to teach them, by God, you're going to tell us this, come hell or high water, that I could see as a chilling kind of motivation, which would undercut the affirmative defense somewhat. So I'm a little troubled by that, but today I would vote to reverse on based upon, and I haven't even gotten into all the actual prima facie case,
yeah,
because I'd just go off on the affirmative defense.
You would vote to reverse, and Commissioner Young and I would vote to affirm, and I think we have two commissions that are still considering. So, yeah, it could, that could change the, we don't really have a clear way at this point of, I think, way that the way the decision would go. So it sounds like we're going to have to have some time for some further thought, perhaps some additional deliberation.
Well, it sounds like to me Commissioner Cohen would affirm. I don't want to talk for you.
Oh, yeah. Did I speak that correctly?
Based on?
No, I'm inclined. You know, I mean, we're talking about inclination.
Inclination.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm
inclined to affirm. Okay. So we may have the majority to affirm tentatively in inclination at this point. One thing I guess I wanted to clarify at the meeting today is that whether we would be asking for any supplemental briefing. You know, this came up in the argument with Mr. Moore about, I think, Commissioner Nakamura, you may have been discussing that with him about whether you wanted some additional.
I mean, right now I'm thinking no.
Yeah. Okay.
If I change my mind. And I guess he's not, Mr. Moore wasn't volunteering it, so.
No, I think, you know, my assumption would be that we would issue some order asking the parties directing Mr. Foss up.
That was just giving him the opportunity, but he didn't bite at it, so.
He didn't jump at it, I think, But I think he indicated if we asked for it, we could provide it.
He's very busy this week.
He is.
Week two.
Why should this week be?
I think that at this point, I'm not sure it's even worth having, Rory try and draft something. I don't know what the view of my colleagues are, whether we just, try and.
Well, if there's enough of the consensus as to the reasons for affirming, and it's tentatively looks three, two, maybe it is right. I'm not sure there's I'm still trying to figure out why you folks want to affirm. No, I'm not kidding. But if Rory understands why you want to affirm, by all means, I think maybe he should do a draft. Rory's younger and smarter than me.
Really puts him on the spot, doesn't
he? Well, but yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe we should have another meeting on that. I don't know.
I think we may have to. I think people are considering things that were raised in the argument still, and considering the comments of each other, here. So I think that may be what's going to be needed to get a little more clarity, because I think even though we may have a tentative majority to affirm, I'm not sure the rationales are all in sync, and we may have to have some one-on-one conversations among, those of us affirming and try and fresh that out a little more, and then he needs to all come together and in some fashion and meet and discuss it further. So that's sort of my view. If anybody wants to argue with that or disagree with that, we can talk about that now. But otherwise, I think I'll just probably be taking the temperature of everybody, next week or something, and then figure out, do we need to just have conversations among ourselves, schedule something, if so, when.
When would we expect to get the transcript?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question.
I think we should get it in 4 days. I'm not quite sure about that. I believe it's before they turn around on this.
Okay, so that would be next week, like sometime next week.
Yeah, at the end of next week.
So maybe, you know, what I would do is maybe wait to the following week after that. I don't have a calendar in front of me. Maybe after we've had the transcript for several days, you know, I'll just kind of take the temperature of people and see what their preference is, you know, if they want to go ahead and have a meeting or just be able to clarify their position in some other fashion. All right, well, I forgot to, yes, thank you, Rory, for your help. I have a feeling you're going to be helping us a lot to go forward. Probably.